Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the public Chaboy Ashiur. Tonight we have with us Rav Yonatan Halevi for the second installment of our series on Chacham Ben Tzion Uziel and the personality of a Posek. Thank you, everyone, for being here live, and thank you, everyone who's going to be listening afterwards. And with that, the floor is yours, Chacham.
Thank you so very much. All right. Thank you so much for having me back. I'm very excited to see all of you, at least those of you that I can see. I'm very happy to have you with me tonight. Again, thank you to Ohad for the introduction and to all those who run this beautiful organization, the Chabura, especially to my dear friend, Rabbi Dweck, who I'm sure increase his success and give him a long and healthy life. But we are currently still in the middle of a war, and with your permission, I would like to bless our chayalim before we begin learning. Everything we learn today should be in their merit. They should go to war in peace and come home in peace. ומן הים הגדול, עד אבוא הערבה בבשה, באוויר, ובים לכם, תלמידי ובני קהילתנו, בין אדוני את אויבינו, הקמים עלינו וגפים אחריהם. הקדוש ברוך הוא ישמור ויצית חיילינו מכל צרה וצוקה, כל נגע ומחלה, וישלח ברכה והצלחה בכל מעשה ידיהם. ידבר שונאינו תחתיהם, ויתרד בחדר ישועה ויתר ניצחון, ויתן בנו כדור, כי אדוני אלוהיכם, ההולך עמכם, להילחם לכם עם אויביכם, להושיע אתכם, ונאמר אמן. We are gathered together tonight to study the second half of an essay that we began last week together in the writings of Rabbi Chaim David Halevi about his rabbi, Chief Rabbi Ben Tzion Meir Chai Uziel. And we discussed last week, or we began opening this conversation about the fact that halakha exists. Yes, there are certain laws. There are laws that are certain. We must keep Shabbat. We must eat kasher. We must fulfill certain mitzvot. But there are areas in halakha which are open to interpretation, either based on the generation, based on circumstances at hand, and that this room that exists in halakha very often is used by chachamim to help a certain generation or a certain person keep halakha properly. And I know that last week this led to some questions about, you know, Shulchan Aruch and about the Rambam and about. And no one here is denying that there are laws that are accepted in the Jewish people. Rather, that there are times where application of those laws is in the hands of the lawmaker. And that the thesis that we are putting forth is that the lawmaker's personality very often can affect or influence the way in which they interpret the law, or in which they decide to apply the halakha to a given situation. And that being said, we're trying to show that the Ahavat Israel, the love of Jewish people, and later that we're going to do today, the love of humanity that exists inside of Harav Uziel, are motivating factors to how he reaches his Piskei Halakha. And though he uses halachic methodology to reach his Piskei Halakha, you cannot divorce the personality of the Posek from the Pesak Halakha that they're rendering right now. And this is very important, because I see very often in the Jewish world, people see certain piskei halacha and they get very surprised. How can someone say something so insensitive? Or how can a posek rule something that is so narrow-minded or so seemingly bigoted or racist or I don't know, another word you want to use, misogynistic? I was going to throw some words out there. Why not? Sometimes it's because halacha applies in a certain way and that our values are off. That can definitely be one of the reasons. But sometimes, and it shouldn't surprise you, that if there's a Talmid Chacham who shows no sensitivity to people, they're numb in their level of sensitivity to others. You find people that say terrible things about women or about non-Jews or about Jews that are different than them. You cannot expect that when it comes to the ruling of halakha, that their attitude is going to change all of a sudden. And by miracle, they're going to become this beautiful person who rules halakhot. And very often, we find that the personality of the posek comes out directly in their piskei halakha. I'd like to just start with a story or two. And I'm thinking about a personality of a Chacham that would remind me of a Rav Uziel, someone that we observed in this generation. Comes to light a Chacham, for example, Chacham Mordechai Eliyahu. Now, you should know, I'm not from that Ben Midrash. He's a very diehard, not just Kabbalistic Ben Midrash. but a certain style of Baghdadi Pesach Halakha, which takes certain Ashkenazi stringencies very seriously, but the personality of the Chacham is what I'm trying to show. Coming up is Purim. And I heard a story from someone who used to come to the chief rabbi Mordechai Eliyahu's house, who was the chief rabbi Uzal. They would come to him for their Sunat Purim. The chief rabbi has people over. You can imagine it's a very important meal. And all of a sudden, they noticed Chacham Mordechai Eliyahu disappeared. And they couldn't figure out where did he go. And they went to look for him. Maybe he's talking to someone outside. They finally found him on the floor of the kitchen. In this kitchen, he was just sitting on the floor. He was there with a little boy. There was a 5 or 6 year old boy who brought a styrofoam sword to go fight the chief rabbi with. And when he came to the chief rabbi's house, the sword snapped in half. And he came crying. Chacham Mordechai noticed that the kid was crying at his table. So he asked the kid, "Hey, what's going on?" He told him about his sword. He said, "Come, I have a super glue in my drawer. I'm going to go fix your sword for you." So they went to the kitchen, and Chacham Mordechai was busy super gluing the stomach plate sword in the kitchen. And I think that this is something that we often overlook, that the humanity of a person comes out everywhere. You have a thing about Chacham Mordechai. Chacham Mordechai once went to the Shiva of a young boy who was maybe 9 years old. He was sitting Shiva over his father. And he came as the chief rabbi of Israel. And he's crying. And Chacham Mordechai says, "Why are you crying?" And he said, "I'm crying because I'm 9 years old. I don't have a father anymore. And I have no clue. How am I going to get through life? How will I be successful?" Chacham Mordechai put him on his lap. He stroked his cheek and said, "My dear son, let me tell you a story about a young boy in Yerushalayim who also lost his father when he was a young boy. And he also was an orphan when he was a young boy. You know what happened to him today? Today he's a Sephardic chief rabbi of Israel, and right now you're sitting on his lap." He said, "Don't worry, I'm going to be with you every step of the way." When you see Talmidei Chachamim like that, you can automatically say, "I'm taking my defenses down. These are the kind of Talmidei Chachamim from whom I wish to learn halakha." And so today I want to walk you through a number of examples from the writings of Harav Uziel that were selected by Rabbi Chaim David Halevi that show you the Ahavat Yisrael factor inside of the Pesukei Halacha. And it's very important to make one more disclaimer, maybe two more disclaimers, okay, by making disclaimers. The first is that these are not decisions that were reached by Rav Uziel purely out of love of the Jewish people. Chacham Uziel shows you his sound halachic methodology throughout his teshuvot. But sometimes the end, the cherry on top, is also there is a factor here, a factor that has to do with loving other people that really pushes him to make a certain decision, but never against halacha, always within the framework of halacha. And number two is that just because I'm teaching you examples today does not mean that I have the opinion that these halachot are what I would feel comfortable doing. We're able to study the rulings of another chacham without subscribing to everything it is that we're reading. So please, these are taught not necessarily halacha lemaaseh. You'll make your own decisions in your own life how you observe halacha. Being that we have maybe 10 pages to cover and only the amount of time that we have, what I'm going to do is I want to share with you each one of the examples outside. And then when there are some very important sentences to read from inside the writings of Rav Uziel, we're going to do it together right now. I'm in the right column on page 4. Rav Uziel is the chief rabbi of Israel at the early years of the Yishuv, the new settlement of the land of Israel. Agriculture is a tremendous industry that's happening in the early Zionist movement. He's also the chief rabbi in the first 5 years of the state of Israel. He passes away in 1953, Baruch Atah Adonai Eloheinu Melech HaOlam Shehakol Nehiyah Lo. And one of the major questions that came up in the last generations is the question of Etrog HaMurkav, an etrog that is grafted. For those of you who don't have the source sheet, I think I see it being posted in the chat box. And also, if you want, you can go to shiviti.org/habura, HABURA, and you'll find the link to download it there. Why would you graft the plant? I taught this to Moshe here last night. We were studying Halachot of the Rambam about Orla. The etrog tree is a very weak tree. Anyone who's tried to grow an etrog from seeds, you'll realize that most of the time you fail because the plant of the etrog is not very strong. The easiest way to grow an etrog would be to graft the etrog plant onto an existing, perhaps citrus plant, let's say a lemon or an orange. I'm not a farmer, so I don't want to tell you that I know exactly how to graft something. And the strength of that tree allows you to grow the atoll fruit. But the question is, are you allowed to recite a beracha on Sukkot with an atoll that's grafted? And listen, there's no right answer to this question. The Chachamim who deal with this question, those who believe it's permissible, they go to war that it's permissible to recite a blessing on a grafted atoll. The Chachamim that prohibit, they go to war, and they are convinced it is prohibited to recite a blessing on an atoll that was grafted. Harav Uziel deals with both sides of the story, and ultimately, he decides that those who say that grafted etrogim are permissible, he rules in that opinion. So, according to Harav Uziel, you're allowed to use a grafted etrog for Sukkot. But here he adds in one more note, and that is, there's a question. I don't mean to mock any tradition, but has anyone ever heard of this fascinating story that Moshe Rabbeinu went all the way to Italy from the desert to go get an atoll? Have you heard this story before? Well, it's because it's not true, but there's a fantastical
Yes.
Hasidic story. Yeah, who said yes?
Kami.
Oh, very good. There's a fantastical Hasidic story. I'm not going to blame all the Hasidim for it. I also don't want to single out exactly which Hasidim I'm referring to. They have in their teachings a story. Listen, today I decided I can't even figure out where some people get things from, but they have a story that Moshe Rabbeinu couldn't find an etrog in the desert. Where did he go? He went all the way to Italy to a certain place called Calabria, or they called him Yanover Etrogim in that Hasidut. And he got an etrog from there. And ever since then, these Hasidim are very careful that they pay a lot of money. I mean, a lot of money extra to buy an etrog that comes from Italy. Now, the real question Rav Uziel is dealing with is there's a whole industry of etrogim that is in Eretz Yisrael. And if you're choosing to buy an etrog from Eretz Yisrael, is it important to choose an Israeli etrog over any other etrog that exists in the world? Harav Kook, Alav Shalom, the contemporary of Rav Uziel, actually has a book in which he tries to prove that it's important to always choose an etrog that comes from Israel. Harav Uziel adds in one more factor. And he says the following, look at the bottom of page 4. Ulama en din kedima Eretz Yisrael. Even though according to Halakha, there is no reason for me to tell you that you must buy fruits or use fruits that only come from Eretz Yisrael, or give them preference. Mikol makom mishum chibat haaretz, mitzvat yishuv Eretz Yisrael. Because of the love of the land of Israel, mitzvah to settle the land of Israel. Mitzvah lehader achrei etrogei Eretz Yisrael. It's a mitzvah to take Israeli etrogim. Kedei lehachzik yedei ha'amelin koach leshev haaretz b'uchlusei Yisrael. In order to support those Jews that are working hard in order to settle the land of Israel with Jewish people. Hu le'amo ba'aretz. And someone who chooses to take an etrog not from Israel is actually causing harm to those people who are working hard to settle the land of Israel and receive a parnasah from the work of their hands. I mean, we have some kind of obligation to support our Jewish brothers and sisters. In fact, on the right side, Harav Uziel takes it one step further. And he says that if you have a choice to take an etrog from Israel, which is grafted, and an etrog not from Israel, which is not grafted, you should choose the etrog that is grafted from Israel and not choose the etrog that is not grafted from outside of Israel. And this is again a place where you see that for Harav Uziel, though halakha was the initial reason why he ruled that grafted etrogim are permissible to use, he still was very clear. What was he clear about? That there's an extra level here in the story, which is support the Jews that are living in Eretz Israel, support the Jews that are settling the land of Israel, support the trade of agriculture. And then someone who chooses not to is sinning a national sin against his people. Example number one. Example number two. What do you do with a religious person who doesn't keep Shabbat? Now, I'm sure those of you who've learned with me long enough to know that I don't split Jewish people into categories. But in this particular case, there was an organization. There was the Histadrut HaPoel Mizrahi. This HaPoel HaMizrahi was a religious group that had membership. And one of the diehard rules of their membership was that a person who joins their ranks and wants to be a member of HaPoel HaMizrahi has to keep Shabbat. It's a deal breaker. If a person doesn't keep Shabbat, that's how they determine that this person couldn't be part of their group. And there was an individual who was part of their group, and he didn't keep Shabbat. He was religious, identified as religious, but didn't observe Shabbat. How did he not observe Shabbat? He was a milkman. and he would deliver milk on Shabbat. And they came to ask Abu Uzziah, what should they do? Should they throw him out? Should they keep him in? And he writes the following: Mehasses anochi bedavar, in the left column on page 4, I'm very nervous to answer this question. I'm hesitant. לפי שמצד אחד עומדת לפניי אזהרת רבותינו ז"ל לעולם תהא שמאל דוחה וימין מקרבת. On one hand, the teaching of our rabbis that you should always push people away with the left hand and bring them closer with your stronger hand, with your right hand. ומאידך, he said, on the other hand, they have that which it says about Pinchas. חושש אני שמא יאמרו התירו פירושים את הדבר. Then no one should think that because we are allowing a member to the organization, that now we've allowed this in our organization, it's okay. You could be religious and not observe Shabbat. And here he says, Ulam mitzaded ani ladun ish zeh lechav zechut. My final opinion, says Abu Uziel, is to judge this person favorably. He probably doesn't know that delivering milk on Shabbat, and he delineates all the problems that could exist in running a business on Shabbat and delivering milk on Shabbat. He probably doesn't know that what he's doing is actually considered breaking Shabbat. Probably thinks it's some stringency that rabbis made up. He's in a rather, what do I suggest? I suggest you take him aside quietly and have a conversation with him. Don't throw him out. Don't come to him with the board says, the committee has rules. Come and talk to him. And I'm certain that such a person, if you talk about to them properly and explain to them that HaMekadesh HaShabbat, that the God who sanctifies the Shabbat and the Jewish person who sanctifies the Shabbat, if they agree to work together and not to work on Shabbat, HaKadosh Baruch Hu will take care of them. I'm sure that you will see that it says, Shalom, Shalom, la'achok, la'kavod. Peace should come both to those Jews who are near and to those Jews that are far. Example number 3. This comes up very often. I'm certain that you know that there's a rule in Halakha, and Rabbeinu HaRambam writes in his commentary in the Mishnah, that the one rule that we have about all the rules is that none of the rules are actual rules, meaning we have general rules. But all general rules have exceptions. For example, there's a rule that women are exempt from time-bound mitzvot. They explain all the details of the background or the evolution of the halakha is beyond the scope of today's shiur. But suffice it to say, then there's a rabbinic rule that men and women are equally obligated in the whole Torah. And the one area which differs is the area of time-bound mitzvot. Mitzvot that can only be fulfilled in a certain amount of time or at a certain time. And therefore, the question arises, can a woman recite a blessing on mitzvot, which she's not obligated in, but she chooses to participate in? The most famous of those is going to be the mitzvah of Sukkah and Lulav. And now, why did I say that it's a rule that has exceptions to the rule? Can you think of a mitzvah that is coming up very soon, that is a time-bound mitzvah, yet women are equally obligated with men, as men in the same mitzvah?
Megillah.
Is it hearing the Megillah?
Very good.
And the Megillah.
Read it. Yeah. So a woman cannot just hear the Megillah, read the Megillah, at least according to the Rambam and the Shulchan Aruch, Mishloach Manot, Matanot Zevioni, all the mitzvot of Purim are time-bound mitzvot. But a woman is obligated on them equally. And the rabbis give a reason. Because they were in the same miracle. But this you're going to find also by the Seder Pesach. You're going to find by many other places. It happens to be that the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch, ruled that the mitzvah of Sukkah and the mitzvah of Lulav, women are exempt from them. And the famous question happens, if a woman wants to recite a blessing on the Sukkah, a blessing on the Lulav, is she allowed to? Seemingly, according to the simple reading of the Rambam, the Shulchan Aruch, the answer is no. Of course she can do the mitzvah. Every person can opt into the mitzvah. But really, to say, Asher kidishanu b'mitzvotav v'tzivanu, I'm obligated in the mitzvah, you cannot say a blessing on something you're not obligated in. The French-German rabbis, Rabbeinu Tam, say the opposite, and that is that a woman can choose to obligate herself, and when she says, shetzivanu, likely she's referring to the collective Jewish people, not just to herself, and this leads to a very major issue, because if I fulfill a mitzvah without saying a blessing, do I fulfill that mitzvah? If I put tefillin on without saying a blessing, have I fulfilled the mitzvah of tefillin?
Yes.
Absolutely. But what's the risk of saying a blessing if I'm not obligated to say a blessing?
Hashem's name in vain.
It's violating one of the Ten Commandments of saying God's name in vain.
Hashem's name in vain.
And therefore, what's the issue? The issue is, why would I choose to violate possibly one of the Ten Commandments if anyways I'm going to fulfill the mitzvah without saying the blessing? And this leads to famous arguments. The rabbis of North Africa observed the custom that some woman there said a blessing on 11 at all. And this has been a debate that's raging until today. I have my own shulim on this topic, but it's not relevant to right now. Haruziel, though, is discussing whether or not a woman is allowed to recite blessings on this mitzvot. Ultimately, Haruziel decides, according to Halakha, that he likes to rule like the opinion that says that a woman can recite such blessings. And so here, what do we see? He adds in one more note, and it's something beautiful. Whether you agree with the conclusion or not, if I had to tell you that in my home, the rabbanit takes 11 at all every day. She sits in the sukkah. The rabbanit sleeps in the sukkah. But from what I know, the rabbanit doesn't say a blessing on those mitzvot, like the Rambam. Here, Harav Uziel adds on the top of page 5 in the bold writing, he says the following. V'zehu b'chol mitzvot. This is true by all the mitzvot. Yotze miklan zeh lulav v'shofar. But there's a difference between the lulav and the shofar. Why? וכיוון שהם רומזים להתאחדות לב כל ישראל לאבים שבשמיים ולהעלת זיכרונם לפניו. Because the mitzvah of lulav and the mitzvah of shofar are intended to bring a person close to their father in heaven. ובזה גם הנשים שייכות בו. And in that idea, also women want to be connected to their father in heaven. לכן רשאות לברך עליהם. And they are therefore permitted to recite a blessing. And this is a minhag that has already spread across the Jewish people, and a person should not change his minhag. Meaning, there's an idea of hitachadut lev kol Yisrael, the unification of the Jewish people together. How can we ask a woman to exclude herself from a mitzvah that is uniting the Jewish people? Now, like I said, my personal opinion is not like this, but Rabbi Uziel is adding here a level of ahavat Yisrael, hitachadut Yisrael, the unity of the Jewish people, as a deciding factor in how we observe a mitzvah or apply a halakha. Harav Uziel was living in difficult times in Europe. There was a major argument surrounding slaughter. And I'm sure those of you who are familiar with the time right after World War II, there was a lot of controversy, a lot of persecution of the Jewish community in certain countries for slaughtering animals. And what they wanted was that Jewish people should stun the animals before slaughtering the animals. They claimed that our slaughtering practices were inhumane and that we were hurting the animals, and therefore they wanted first for the animal to be stunned and then to be slaughtered. And the rabbis in Europe, they reached out to Rav Uziel, asking for his opinion. And very soon, Rav Uziel explains clearly why he believes that the method in which we slaughter animals is correct and is humane, that doesn't cause unnecessary pain or harm to the animal. But in addition, he added a factor, and I think this is very important. He said it's very interesting that those people who would throw out the term tsar ba'alei chayim, you're causing suffering to animals, have no second thoughts about causing suffering to human beings. How so? You're publicly persecuting the Jewish community and accusing them of hurting animals and accusing them of some of the most evil things daily, every day. And you're willing to protect a cow or a chicken more than you care about the dignity of human beings. Rav Uziel saw in this not just something that was not true, but something which showed hypocrisy. How can you claim to care about humanity when you don't actually care about human beings first? And this was something Rav Uziel called him out on. Leads to a similar question that has to do with Shechita. If you look on page 5 on the left side, there's a famous halakha that an animal whose lungs are punctured is considered a non-kasher animal, especially since our Chachamim saw that an animal whose lungs are punctured is inevitably going to die sooner than later, and therefore the milk that comes from such an animal is not kasher. How would you know if an animal's lungs are punctured? The answer is you wouldn't. You rely on a chazakah that most cows' lungs are not punctured. But what happens in a situation, like in today's dairy industry, where oftentimes they inject, and I'm not telling you it's healthy, I'm not telling you that it's good for you, I'm not telling you that this is the kind of dairy products you should consume, I'm simply telling you this is the reality in the market, that when an animal gets sick, or in order to produce more milk, or increase whatever they might do, increase milk production, take care of diseases, whatever reason they might have, that oftentimes they inject into the lungs of an animal all kinds of hormones and antibiotics and different things like that. And therefore, very often, we know that the animal that we're milking right now, yesterday, had its lungs punctured. Is it permissible or prohibited to consume the milk that comes from such animals? Harav Uziel deals with the whole halachic sugya and ultimately rules that it's permissible. On the left side, though, if you look in the second paragraph, he adds one extra non-halachic reasoning for why he's permitting it. Because the times, desperate times call for this. Mishum shim navo leso, because if we say this milk is prohibited, nishlol efsharut shel meshek ha-chalav al yedei Yisrael, we will totally destroy the Jewish dairy industry. V'nimna anaf kalkali gadol lefarnasat balei ha-meshakim u'mzonot ha-tzibur kulo, and we will cause irreparable damage to the Jewish economy that is budding in the land of Israel. And so he then says, but I'm not comfortable. Let me ask my colleague, Chief Rabbi Herzog. He sends a letter to Chief Rabbi Herzog. And when Chief Rabbi Herzog responds that he also agrees, halachically, that one can be vigilant on the topic, and look on the bottom left, he says, Kuntreso karati le simchati haraba. Penuach da'ato kemoshi niach da'ati. He said, you should, I'm so happy, Rabbi Herzog, that you agreed to permit, and may God comfort you the way you have comforted me. Ki ma'az amda shela zot defanai hitzta'arti ma'od defitrona. He said, ever since the question came before me, I was suffering tremendously the thought that I would cause damage to Jewish farmers. But now that I see that you have agreed with me, I'm so happy. I'm so happy with the conclusion that we can now be lenient and help the Jewish farmers. Again, you see how much he took the plight of other people to heart when ruling halachic rulings. On page 6, this is relevant sometimes to today's economy. According to Halakha, it seems to be that Torah scholars are exempt from paying certain taxes. There are taxes and there are taxes, but the Talmidei Chachamim are given a pass by the sages of the Jewish people that certain taxes Torah scholars are exempt from. There was an organization in Yerushalayim called the Vaad Ha'edah HaSefaradit, the Committee of the Sephardic Community. And everyone who was in the Sephardic community had to pay taxes to this committee of Sephardim. And at a certain point, there were Torah scholars who, they were struggling financially, and they felt, hey, why do we have to pay taxes to the Sephardic organization? We have Chief Rabbi Uziel. He can get us off the hook. He should be able to apply the halakha and convince them not to tax us. And they reach out to Rabbi Uziel for assistance. And Rabbi Uziel deals halakhically with this whole conversation. And especially, he deals with the claims that perhaps the committee of Sephardim is misappropriating funds, meaning the Torah scholars were saying, we're paying taxes. We don't even feel that the money is going to where it needs to go. We'd rather not pay taxes at all. And Rabbi Uziel decides the following. That even though the Sephardic Central Committee is not always to be relied upon, they do things that need to be challenged, and we should fix those problems from within, said Rabbi Uziel. But can you imagine how terrible it would be if Torah scholars would exempt themselves from being involved in the building of the land of Israel? This is not a random tax. The tax that Torah scholars were exempt from is not a tax that goes to help society, goes to fix roads, goes to feed the poor. The tax that Talmidei Chachamim are obligated in is one that other people are obligated in. And he said, it's your obligation to pay the taxes. And that which it says, Talmidei Chachamim, Marbim Shalom Ba'olam, the Torah scholars increase peace in the world. Part of that is when the world sees that Torah scholars join in with them in the projects that are committed to them equally. That increases peace in the Jewish people, and it will bring blessing to the Jewish people as well. This next question is a difficult one. It has to do with conversions. And forgive me that I'm flying through some of these. I want to be able to cover as many of them as I can before we have to call it a night tonight or a day today, depending where you live. If a non-Jewish woman is married to a Jewish man, and at a certain point they decide they want to do teshuvah, and she wants to convert to Judaism, there are two questions. The first question is, do we accept her even as a convert? I mean, is she converting for the right reasons? Do we want to help a person who initially started in Avira? And the second is, there's a category in halakha called Yimei Havchana, in which we cause a spouse to separate from their non-Jewish spouse during a conversion process, or right after the conversion process, depending how you look at this. And it's in order to make sure that if a woman is pregnant, if the baby was born or was conceived before the conversion happened or afterwards, what that has to do with halakha. Really, I'm not here to stick my nose in that. There's a famous teshuvah out of New York. I don't want to tell you which chacham. Suffice to say, it's a Torah scholar whose books I don't have in my bookcase. But this Talmid Chacham was asked a question about a young man from the Jewish community who had left the Jewish community, went to go live with a non-Jewish woman. And at this point in his life, he had decided that he wanted, really wanted to get close to HaKadosh Baruch Hu again. And he started explaining to this girlfriend, and this wife of his, how much he loved Hashem. And she got so excited, she was willing to convert also. And they approached this Dayan in New York and asked him if he would help convert her so they could join the Jewish community again. What do you think his answer was? His answer was, I have no obligation towards you. You decided to leave. You went with a non-Jewish lady. Now you want to come back. We don't need Jews like you. If I help you out, it's going to teach all the other young people they can do what you're doing. And when I read that Tishu B'Av and I compare it to that of Uziel, who talks about how he loses sleep at night, knowing that there are couples that are intermarried. And if he could just lower some of the conversion standards in order to convince her to join the Jewish people, even on a very basic level, he would be so thrilled to return the sons and daughters of HaKadosh Baruch Hu back to him. You're dealing with two completely different mentalities in how you approach halacha. In particular, Uziel said that as much as he hesitates to make this an official ruling, in a situation where the Beit Din sees that a couple will not separate, and that separation will cause them to perhaps not pursue a conversion, says Rabbi Uziel, it's better that we lower our conversion standards and allow them to convert that way than to push them away by expecting from them things that are not able to be expected. Rabotai, I have a Beit Din for conversion. And all I can say is that Giur is not an easy topic. I don't necessarily judge those Talmidei Chachamim who are difficult in the way they approach Giur. But I will say that there need to be Talmidei Chachamim who are welcoming people down the side. And I'm very lucky. I feel a big zechut in my life that I have the opportunity to be sitting with Talmidei Chachamim. I sit together with Rabbi Moshe Ben Zaken, Rabbi Yosef Zanigian, under the leadership of Mori HaRav Yaakov Peretz. And sometimes we have a responsibility towards the Jewish people, and it may look unusual, but that's where our loyalty stands first. Can we help as many people return to Am Yisrael as possible? Agunot. In 1921, because all the violence towards Jews in Eretz Israel only started after the beginning of the Zionist occupation in 1948. Can you tell me what happened in 1921? That was sarcastic, by the way. Oh, sarcastic. What happened in 1921?
Was it
Do you remember?
Massacre?
What?
Was it the Hebron massacre?
No, not that one. Close.
Tarpat.
Hebron.
In Tel Aviv. In Tel Aviv, you had the Jewish Communist Party and the Jewish Socialist Party, of course. They were both demonstrating in the streets of Tel Aviv, and they ended up going to war against each other. What happens when Jews fight each other? They think they're right. They think they're strong. They think they're doing well. The Arabs viewed this as an opportunity. The Jews are weak. Let's start attacking Jews. And it became a huge, and they called them riots. They're not riots. It was a murderous campaign, which Jews were being slaughtered and attacked and beaten, raped. Terrible things that happened there. In 1921, the Jews of Tel Aviv were under attack. There was a young lady who was married, and her husband, he had heard that there were attacks by Arabs on Jews, and he went from Petah Tikva to Tel Aviv to go help the Jewish community there. And as Abu Ziel writes, this young lady has been in the Beit Din for a number, about 10 years. So he's writing this letter in 1931 about that for 10 years, she's coming to the Beit Din, day in and day out. Her husband never made it to Tel Aviv, and her husband never came back to Petah Tikva. Her husband was lost. For all we know, he was killed by somebody, his body thrown in a pit, his body thrown in the ocean. We have no clue what happened there. You know, Uziel writes on page 7 that he sees how much she's suffering. And all he wants to do is try to figure out how can he help this young lady so she can continue with her life, and which halakhic mechanisms can he use in order to save her from the chains of being an aguna. And that brings us to another sensitive area in the life of Uziel, and that is agunot in general. See, the classic case of an aguna is the one I just mentioned to you. A woman's husband disappears. We don't know where he is. We don't know if he's alive. We don't know if he's dead. We cannot just let her remarry, because what happens if the guy shows up? In 2 years, he got lost in Baghdad. He came back. He was arrested over there. He didn't have a way to communicate. Now she's married to another man, Chas v'Shalom. The children are all mamzerim. That's a classic case of an aguna. Unfortunately, since the rise of Judaism, which didn't care much about their Judaism, you had another level of agunot, which was women who were married to men who did not want to grant them a divorce. I don't want to get arrested, so I'm going to be very careful. The Sephardic community has many clever solutions to that, namely that of the Rambam, which is the guy doesn't have a choice. You don't get to hold your wife in agunah forever. If you don't want to give her a get, the Beit Din will just take you behind the Beit Din, will beat you until you're willing to give your wife a get. If you still don't want to give her a get, we'll beat you some more. You have a lot of body parts we can break, and we'll break you until you are a good person, says the Rambam. How is that not a contract that was written under duress? Says the Rambam, something fascinating. Says deep down inside, that Jewish man just wanted to be good to his wife. He didn't want to hurt her. So we just motivated him to let his inner good person out. And that might seem like cruel and evil and terrible. And definitely the rabbis of Europe thought that that was a terrible mentality. But for us, this was the attitude. Who is going to protect our daughters from evil men? The Beit Din. The Beit Din is going to make sure that nobody's going to play with our daughters. Nobody's going to play games. Once the Beit Din has decided that a man must give his wife a gift, he's going to give his wife a gift. I'm not condoning violence. We do not do this in the modern era to people. I'm not telling you that's what you should do. I'm simply telling you that was one solution. What ended up happening was when Uziel was corresponding with the rabbis of Kushta of Istanbul. Over there became a situation where many men did not want to give their wives gittin, either because they wanted to hurt them or because they had become less careful about their Judaism and didn't care to come to Beit Din. And ultimately, there were all kinds of different solutions that were suggested. Whether you can add a clause to the ketubah, whether you should make a prenup in order to help make a get happen easier. There are all kinds of different solutions. This correspondence takes a number of years, but mainly the year 1935 is a very heavy year of correspondence with Rabbi Uziel and the rabbis of Turkey. Rabbi Yaakov Moshe Toledano, who you may have heard me teach his writings on Purim last year about the Jewish right to self-defense. He wrote a very famous solution to this problem in which instead of a couple marrying each other, a couple would marry each other by proxy, meaning via the Beit Din, al da'at Rabbanan. And therefore, the husband marries the wife with the permission of the Beit Din, and the woman accepts to be married by permission of the Beit Din. How the halakha mechanism works, I can explain it at a different time, but ultimately, at the moment in which the Beit Din feels that the man is not being loyal to what he promised would happen at the wedding, the Beit Din has the opportunity to annul the wedding because you only got married by proxy of us, and we now say that she's free to go. She does not need a divorce. However, Uziel was very worried for one simple reason. Look on page 8. And he says the following. Ve'od ani omar, I just want to say one thing. She'la zo biyotah she'la klalit. Because this is a question that is a general question. All of the Jewish people are going to be affected by the relationship status that comes out of this decision. We cannot allow one rabbi or one bedin in one country to make their own decision about this. Rather, this must happen collectively. The Jewish people have to accept that we're not going to treat this lady as a married woman anymore if we accept this ruling in Halakha. Ultimately, since the 1935, all kinds of really ridiculous suggestions have been proposed, some very good ones, some very ridiculous ones. The more ridiculous ones are the ones that are prevalent right now. Ultimately, Rav Uziel's suggestion, Rabbi Toledano's suggestion, was rejected for not very good reasons, maybe a little bit. And what ended up happening is Rabbi Chaim David HaLevi writes at the bottom, on page 8, Bayot kashot ele mamshichot b'yeter set v'yeter oz la'adir shnatam shel dayanim rabim b'Yisrael u'tzareinu nevuotav ha'agumot shemaran harav itkaimu b'minuam. Ve'omitz lev l'pitron ha'baya adayin en, says the Rav Uziel was a prophet that this problem would only get worse. And even though the problem has become worse, that there are many, many women who are suffering at the hands of evil men, what we have found is though the problem got worse, the dayanim didn't get better. The dayanim lack the courage to step up to the plate and make decisions that will save women from suffering in these situations. I don't want to talk about this topic more. If you want, in the questions, we can. Obviously, it's a topic that is very close to my heart. In 1914, Rav Uziel was involved in a story in which a group of young boys, I don't know all the circumstances, had come over to a girl and given her a ring and said, "Hareyat Mikudeshli, you married me." There were witnesses, there were all kinds of people there. And now this boy thought it was so funny that she was maybe considered married. The girl comes running to the Beit Din. Am I married? Am I not? He said, "Listen, it's really simple. Let's just get him to give a get just in case you are married." And the boy said, "Over my dead body, I'm not going to give a get." And Rav Uziel went out of his way to help this girl be freed without a get because he said, "How can I see this girl suffering? That's our daughters, their young boys are going to play games with them. They're going to hurt the dignity of our daughters. They're going to be suffering because of children who lack any type of compassion and kindness. And Uziel didn't stop until his Bedin had solved this problem. Turn to page 9 with me. There was a situation in which a group of ignoramuses saw that a woman needed a divorce. They didn't come to the Bedin. Rather, what did they do? They went to the bookshop. They took out a book on how to write gittin. And they wrote a get. They gave it to the woman. And they had no knowledge on how Hilchot Gittin works, how the laws of divorce work, how the laws of marriage. There were just three people from the synagogue. And now this woman came to the rabbi to ask him, am I really divorced? Am I not? And it was a very complicated situation. Ultimately, Rabbi Uziel said that he's going to take this problem on his shoulders. He sees that other people don't care enough about her to deal with this problem. He wants to see how he can help her to make it. What was the problem? Why not just give her another get? In the interim, she had remarried and had new children. And if Uziel would rule that the original get was not kasher, all the children would be mamzerim, and she would not be allowed to even perhaps live with the husband that she had married a second time. And therefore, Uziel worked very, very hard in order to make sure that she would be freed from this catastrophe that she found herself in. On page 9, this is a sugya. I really don't want to jump into too deeply, but as sexual permissiveness became prevalent even in the Jewish community, and young people were having sexual relations with other young people before marriage, there began to be a shaking or a shaking up of the rabbinic world and how we deal with couples that are in relationships that are not married to each other. In halakha, there seems to be a concept that if a woman has relations, premarital relations with men, that she cannot say that man is the father of my child because he can argue back, listen, she sleeps around with a lot of people, and how do I know that it's my child? Maybe it's the other guy's child. And here was a situation where a young girl had become pregnant. The story happened, if I'm not mistaken, in Morocco. In Meknes, in Morocco, that a young boy and a young girl, she got pregnant from him, and they came to the Bedin. The Bedin was very concerned because maybe halakhically, we can't expect this boy, this young man, to pay child support and to take care of her financially, because there's halakhic reason for him to get off the hook. On the flip side, the Bedin of Morocco was worried about four things. If you look on the top of page 9 on the left, they were worried that she might go for an abortion. They were worried that maybe she would give the baby up and just throw him in a dumpster after he was born. Lo aleinu, these are things that happen all the time in this country. Third, they were worried that maybe somebody would try to kill the child. Family honor, who knows what might happen over there. Or number four, that in order to hide the family shame, somebody might sell this child and give away this child to a non-Jewish orphanage, and this child who's Jewish would be raised otherwise in a non-Jewish setting. Habuziel initially sets out the whole argument. And finally, Habuziel said that he's going to do what he can to help this young girl receive the financial support that she needs from this man, while still trying to maintain a certain face of this type of behavior on both parties' side is not acceptable inside of our community. And Uziel worked very hard in order to show that even though Avat Yisrael is a factor, but that sometimes part of Avat Yisrael requires Yikov Hadin at the house. You have to put your foot down and also rebuke people for engaging in behavior that the Bedin doesn't always want to have to cover up for. Now we know Uziel struggled with this mentality his whole life. In Mishlei, it says, "Miftach sefatayim, I wish to open up my mouth in righteousness and justice." Look on page 10. In the introduction to Choshen Mishpat, to Mishpatei Uziel, the response of Uziel Choshen Mishpat, Uziel has a real dilemma. How does one balance loyalty to the law with compassion for the Jewish people? Either you're going to be a legal loyalist, or you're going to be compassionate on people, but it's very hard to have two competing values. How do you do that? How does a judge determine that I'm not being biased towards a person, or I'm not being too rigorous, too rigid in my interpretation of the law? This is something that really, really concerned Abu Zia. And he writes on the left side of page 10, Dayanei Yisrael b'chol zman. The judges of Israel in every generation, have dedicated themselves wholeheartedly in every generation to bring about peace between people. V'hem hitzigu et dmutah shel yahadut bezakuta v'taharata. And they were responsible for presenting the most beautiful, pure Judaism that exists in the world. The Dayanei Yisrael hishtakfa dimutah shel yahadut kula. When people wanted to judge the Jewish people, they judged it based on the leaders of the Jewish people. And therefore, the leaders of Israel are the representatives of Israel. V'hem hayu v'chem tzuchim liyot haregulatorim, this is not a Hebrew word, ha'omdim ala hegev ala mitzpeh. And therefore, the judges of Israel, they must be the regulators of Judaism. They are the ones who are sitting at the steering wheel, the ones who are in the watchtowers. Really, a hege is the rudder of a ship, but today we use it as the steering wheel. L'chaven hadarchim ביצור חומות השלום והאחדות של יסודות הנצחיות של עם ישראל בתורתו. That the sages of Israel have a responsibility to bring peace and unity, which are the eternal foundations of Israel and the Jewish people. And he says, so how does a judge do it? That a judge who is sitting on the throne of judgment realizes, look at the top of page 10, התשובה הקצרה אבל נוקבת ויורדת עד התהום היא, my only answer that I have, how you balance these two loyalties, V'haya Adonai Mashofet, that God should be with the judge. Shechinat HaKodesh and Elohei HaMishpat, the holy divine presence of the God of justice, Omedet Lemala Miroshon Shel HaDayan, is hovering above the head of the judge. B'shifto Al Kiseh HaMishpat, when he's sitting on the throne of judgment, Kulo Atuf Yira V'Chanada, and he's cloaked the judge in fear and awe, B'objektiviyut Gemura, with complete objectivity. A judge must approach halakha with complete objectivity, also knowing that I need God to be with me. Because without the siyata d'shmaya, without the assistance of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we can make tremendous mistakes in interpreting or applying the Torah to the situations that are before us. I think this is a major element that most people don't want to talk about because we don't have a yirat shamayim thermometer. I don't have a little device I can tell you, stick this on the head of your rabbi and find out if he has yirat shamayim. But what I can tell you, the only faith that we have that human beings will interpret the Torah properly is that they are going to be purely objective and absolutely loyal to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the God of Israel. I sometimes see by weddings, I'm going to be doing a few weddings coming up. Some of you are in the class. I'm doing your weddings coming up, Bezat Hashem. So when we give the ring, and the Chatan says, Harei at mikudeshet li, you are married to me betamadzo with this ring, kedat Moshe v'Yisrael, according to the laws of the Jewish people in Israel. And you say, how can someone then perform a wedding which is not in accordance to the laws of Moshe and Israel? Everything that we do must be with absolute loyalty to the God of justice who made us the lawmakers. And a lawmaker who acts with that kind of humility and that kind of objectivity and that kind of yirat shamayim, then we can be certain that HaKadosh Baruch Hu will not allow them to stumble. I'm trying not to skip anything. Sorry, I missed the sentence before, but aginut. Doesn't matter. Let's look on page 10 at the bottom left. This question is an important question, and I promise that it will make some of you uncomfortable. We've mentioned so far how Rav Uziel's love of Jewish people. Rabbi Chaim David HaLevi feels that there's an element that we did not mention yet, and that was his love of all humanity, of all human beings. The question that Rav Uziel was struggling with was the following. In the early years of the Jewish Yeshua, when the Jewish people were planning what would a future state of Israel look like, what would our legal system look like, and I've taught in my Mishpat Tzedek class, the dream Rav Uziel had was that we were finally going to have a Jewish country that followed the Jewish legal system. That's not exactly how it happened. But in preparing for that, Rav Uziel wanted to know what would be the status of the testimony of a non-Jewish citizen of the state of Israel in a Jewish court of law. It's connected to a much larger conversation Could non-Jews serve in Jewish government? What about Dayanim and Abedin, judges in a court? There's a teaching by rabbis in Masechet Avot. Chaviv Adam, how precious is human being? Shenivra B'Tselem, was created in the image of God. Famously, Rav Uziel really argued with Hav Kook, his contemporary. And when he said that, when it says that God breathed into man a nishmat chayim, a soul of life, that when God created man in his image, there was no Jew or non-Jew then. We're all human beings. Jews and non-Jews are created in the image of God. And this goes very deeply into the conversation surrounding religious humanism. If you wish to study more about this, I highly suggest Kamsa Ur Alav Shalom has a number of articles and entries in different books of his on religious humanism, that of Vico as a non-Jew and Chachamei Sefarad who followed in those footsteps. In my opinion, this area of halakha has not yet been adequately surveyed and studied to go through thousands of Sephardic Chachamim, especially, and look in their writings to find the love and the appreciation and the respect that they had for other religions, for other people of other nationalities, other ethnicities, other races. It would be such a healing experience for Jewish people to have access to so many of those texts across the spectrum of Chachamim. Chaim David HaLevi seems to add this in because he was very, very hurt that in his generation, there was a religious lobby in the Knesset who tried to strike down a law. The Knesset was trying to ban, was trying to implement a law against racism. And certain religious, the collective religious lobby in the Knesset had struck down this law in fear that this law against racism would somehow harm the Torah, would stop rabbis from being able to teach Torah properly. And Rabbi Chaim David HaLevi was shell-shocked. He said, my Torah has nothing racist inside of it. My Torah loves all humanity. How could it be that in order to defend the Torah, you think that you must stand up for racism? And this broke Rabbi Chaim David HaLevi. And so this question came up in the writings of Abu Ziyad, page 11. Hamishtar hamemshalti achadash ba'artenu, the new government in our land, orer sefekot merubim sheyesh lahem erech medini ve'ezrachi, has brought up new questions, political and civil questions. Ve'achat ha'sheilot hi b'inyan edut. One of them is about testimony. Im efshar lehachshir edut lo yehudim edim Torah. Are we able, according to the Torah, to accept the testimony of a non-Jewish person in court? If not on a biblical level, on a rabbinic level, can we enact a ruling that allows for us to accept a non-Jew's testimony in court? And what it says in the second paragraph? One of the greatest parts of our future redemption will be the redemption of Jewish law. To bring back Jewish law to what it should be. And one of the greatest purposes of redemption is to restore Jewish lawmakers and law to its place. In Rav Uziel's utopian dreamland, will be building a Jewish country that follows Jewish law. Can we accept the testimony of a non-Jew and rule halachot based on it? If I'm going to tell you no, a non-Jew's testimony, according to the reading of the Talmudic text, cannot be accepted in court. He said, I cannot say that because it would be incorrect on a level of ethics and morality to say that those people who live with us, we cannot count them as equal citizens in a court of law. People who do business with us and interact with us in truth and in innocence and kindness. Were we not complaining about discrimination in the countries of our exile, that the non-Jews didn't count Jews for anything? Then, if every proper enlightened nation on earth They accept the testimony of any individual, regardless of their race, their ethnicity, their religion. How can it be that the Jewish people who are coming to the land of Israel to restore our legal system, we're going to be worse than all the other righteous nations out there that accept everybody's testimony, regardless of who they are? And Rabbi Uziel brings two famous precedents, that of the rabbis of France. We know we have our opinions there. The rabbis of France who claim there is no explicit prohibition in the Torah prohibiting non-Jews from testifying, and the rabbis of Baghdad in the times of the Gaonim, who the rabbis of Baghdad write that when non-Jews were vetted by non-Jewish courts, the Gaonim of Baghdad said that in Baghdad, the courts didn't accept testimony from every non-Jew. They first vetted to see were they a witness of good character. If the non-Jewish court accepted the testimony of a witness, then the rabbis would rule halakha in Bedin based on the testimony that was collected in the non-Jewish court of law. And ultimately says, Ha'abuziyah, that we can rely on these precedents to allow such a thing to happen in the modern state of Israel. And he says, ultimately, in the end, Devarim elu katafti lo lahalacha velo lamaseh, el lamasa umatan shebiru halacha. He said, I write these ideas only to begin the conversation, but not actually to rule for you what should be done. I'm on our final page, page 12, and I know that the clock is ticking almost to the end, so allow me just to conclude with you. Rabbi Uziel dealt with a very interesting sugya of if we had a Jewish country and the Jewish country had elections, what would be the minimum age in which a person would be allowed to vote? They were debating the age of 18. Rabbi Uziel strongly felt that the age of 20 was the right age to allow people to vote, though he said that if the law of the land would say 18, then he would not argue with the law of the land, even though he felt it would contradict halakha. If you look on the top left of page 12, is the reason he's even engaging in this question? That I'm involving myself here in order to bring peace to our settlement in the land of Israel. Everything that Rabbi Uziel did surrounded this topic. That was the title of his will. One day, maybe you and I will study Rabbi Uziel's will together. It's a fascinating study. Rabbi Uziel says we must balance always peace in truth. We must love both equally. And if you see in the life of Uziel that always, wherever he was, no matter what he was involved in, as much as he was looking objectively at halakha, he never forgot for one moment the love of Jewish people and human beings as a whole that was in front of him. And we see this in our concluding thoughts on page 12. At the bottom is a picture of Uziel with Rabbi Chaim David Halevi standing in the background as his secretary. Sitting next to Rabbi Uziel on the right side is Rabbi Herzog. He was the chief rabbi of Ireland and then became the chief Ashkenazi rabbi of Israel. He writes a letter to a certain Talmid Chacham. If you look on the left side of the concluding thought section, you're a Torah scholar who was involved in agriculture and learning Torah. Said, I'm blessing you, my honorable friend, the Torah scholar. I bless you that you should spend more time in the depths of halakha. That's based on a verse in Yehoshua that he was, he dwelled in the valley. And Achim said, what valley? The valley of halakha. Ulafriach ba'avodato gam et admat ha'emek ve'gam ruach yoshveha baneha boneha. I bless you that not only do you build the land, but you build the spirit of the people in the land. You're a Torah scholar. You can affect both. Shivnu et shomemut ha'aretz, that our people should merit to build the desolate lands of Israel. That we should merit to rebuild the land of Israel in the spirit of Hashem that is in the Torah that are resting over us. That we should merit to see what you and I have already merited seeing, the return of the people of Israel to the land of Israel. That we should hear soon the voice of the shofar of our redemption. That all of our enemies will stop and they will tremble at the sound of our redemption. ulkolo itkapsu kol kibusei Yisrael me'atzot pezurehem. And then all of us, you and me, in San Diego, in London, in every country in between that's outside of Eretz Yisrael, that we should gather together from all of our exiles. We are in exile. We are not home. In Eretz Yisrael, you are home. We all have to have a plan to be home. I say this to myself, like I say it to you. And where are we going to go? El HaKodesh Yerushalayim. We're all striving. What our friends in Hamas call it? Al-Aqsa flood. We are all striving to flood Al-Aqsa. Forgive me, the Chabura, I'm going to have to edit this one out. We are all striving to go back to Harabait. Don't play games with HaKadosh Baruch Hu and say, we're going to Israel, and not to the occupied territory of Israel. We're going to Israel, but not to Harabait. The chief rabbi says, you can't go to Harabait. What does it matter what chief rabbi says when the Mishnah says that we can go to Harabait? What does it matter when we have a mitzvah to go to Harabait? What does it matter when HaKadosh Baruch Hu told us already? He's going to build our Beit HaMikdash again with our own hands on Harabait. We must, as a Jewish people, believe in this message of Abu Zeid. We are in the right. We are fulfilling the destiny of Am Yisrael. Am Yisrael has returned home. Am Yisrael is fighting enemies, foreign and domestic. Am Yisrael is at war right now. And the only thing we must hear from Am Yisrael is that all of us, in Israel and outside of Israel, we have the back of our soldiers, of our brothers, and our sisters, who will be there soon enough. And then when we are ready to rebuild this land fully, then our final goal will be Yeshuv Kisot Mishpam, Yeshuv Kisot Mishpam, Kisot David David, that on that holy mountain, we will restore justice of Am Yisrael. We'll bring the lawmakers, Hashiva, Shoftenu Kivarishona. We want Chachamim like Abu Zeid to guide us again. Chachamim who will sit on those thrones of justice, and we won't tremble or shudder and say, maybe they're corrupting Jewish law, maybe they're oppressing us, maybe they want to hurt us, maybe they're making stringencies, maybe they want to make our life miserable, those rabbis, these rabbis, never again. We have chachamim like Abu Zeid that are absolutely loyal to Halakha, that know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is hovering over them, and that are guiding us on a path of truth, but also on a path of love, a path of closeness, a path of shalom, of peace and achdut and unity. Bezat Hashem, we should merit of time to be day, only as in two closing words. He says, Amen, Vamen. Bezat Hashem. Kevin, thank you so much for learning with me today. I really, really appreciate having the opportunity to be here together at the Chabura. And God willing, if anyone needs to go, please feel free to go. I will stick around to answer any questions you might have. If Ohad has any housekeeping he has to do before we dismiss everybody, please. I'm turning over the camera to you.
Thank you so much. That was a very inspiring presentation. If anyone has any questions, comments, they can unmute, raise their hands, write in the chat box, and feel free. I'll start off by asking, How do we create the environment to bring about people like Chacham today?
How do we create the environment too? I didn't hear that kind of.
How do we create the environment to inspire people to become like Chacham Uziel? Meaning, how do we create Chacham Uziel?
Wow, that's a big question. That's a big question. It would purport that I have an answer to it, but I have thoughts because I also stay up late at night wondering how. Okay, I'm going to tell you something, maybe it doesn't sound popular. In Jewish tradition, we have two types of leaders. We have Chachamim and we have Nevi'im. We have prophets and we have scholars. And our rabbis tell us, Chacham Adif Minavi, we prefer scholars over prophets. And the understanding that I have of that is that if you look in Jewish history, under the guidance of Yirmiyahu and Yechezkel and Yeshayahu, the Jewish people were hearing all about beautiful things like peace with our enemies and the rebuilding of the Beit HaMikdash or the restoring of righteousness to Yerushalayim and all these wonderful big picture visions. But you see that the Jewish people were busy murdering each other and worshiping idols and doing all the most terrible things in the world. All of a sudden, come the Chachamim to the world. Chachamim give us no great visions for humanity, for the Beit HaMikdash, for peace with their enemies. All they're busy telling us, what a Chachamim adds to the Jewish tradition. And they add a few mitzvot, like washing your hands before you eat bread or lighting candles before Shabbat starts. And the Jewish people, they run with those things. Try telling a person not to light Shabbat candles before Shabbat. They go to war against you. And what you find is when Chachamei Yisrael micromanaged every legal detail in people's life and ignored the greater vision, The Jewish people became very religious. It was like a like wow, they finally stopped worshiping idols, they stopped killing each other for the most part, and everything became great. And there's a certain understanding that Chokhmah, the wisdom of our sages, was greater than the bigger picture of Judaism that forgot that we were dealing with real people who were struggling with real people things. And the hope that we have for the redemption is that we will have a Chacham who's also a Navi, this personality that is the future redeemer, whether it's a person or a period. I'm not here to speak about the Mashiach, but the idea is that we will have Chachamim who are also Navi. We'll have leaders who know how to focus on the big picture while also focusing on the details of Judaism. And I think what we've done in our generation is we've created, again, prophets and scholars again. There are certain Batei Midrash you're going to go to, and they'll give you a 3-hour shiur on how you can rip toilet paper on Shabbat if you don't have enough pre-cut toilet tissue. And is it that you rip it not on the perforation, or you rip it on the perforation, or maybe I was on a shiur once about Talmid Chacham who claimed, no, you have to wipe yourself with the roll and then put it, forgive me, I'm telling you these things in the Batei Midrash, and then put it in the toilet and flush the toilet, it'll rip on its own because you're only causing it to rip in the toilet. And you're sitting here for 3 hours in the Batei Midrash saying, wow, Am Yisrael came to the world to give everybody the halachot of toilet paper on Shabbat. But then you go to another Beit HaMikdash and they're going to talk about Tikkun Olam and loving the world and peace with the Arabs and all beautiful concepts. You look at Shabbat, it's desecrated every Shabbat over there. Kashrut is not even a thing. You know exactly what I'm telling you. I'm alluding to things that I think everyone understands. And what we're striving for is a type of Chacham who knows how to think big picture, macro Judaism, while not forgetting micro Judaism. And I think the only way to do that is to restore the type of Limud Torah that we had yesterday. It's a type of Limud Torah which is one focused purely on classic texts. And if I had to tell you all we would study, Mikra, Mishnah, Talmud, Halakha, Rambam, Shulchan Aruch, and then other books of classic works that would improve our character traits and our midot and other things like that, and leave all the other detail-oriented, obsessive, compulsive books that exist out there, leave them on the bookshelf and focus on that, coupled with a very healthy understanding of secular sciences and wisdoms, a very healthy understanding of human psychology and sociology, the problems of the world, and the ability to create Torah scholars who are naturally wholesome people. Haguziel, I don't think it was intentional. Nobody intended to create him like this. He simply was born in a world where being normal and being well-rounded and being wholesome was the expectation we had of everybody. I feel like if Rav Uziel came today and would meet some of us, not us here, obviously, he wouldn't believe how in such a short amount of time we had created so many Frankensteins. It would be an unusual thing for Rav Uziel. And I think that really it's about restoring the proper education and a Jewish community that could appreciate and respect such educated people. But listen, you're doing it already, Ohad. So this fact that you exist and this Chabura exists and all of these members here and the members of the public exist, I mean, this is one of the greatest things to happen to the Jewish people in a very long time, in my opinion. The platform of that has been given to Talmidei Chachamim and academics from across the spectrum, even those who don't agree with each other, and having people all over the world who want to connect to that, I think this is a tremendous step in the right direction. What did Neil Armstrong say? Yeah, it's one. What is the famous sentence? A one step for mankind and one huge leap for humanity. It's mamash like that. I think what you're doing is exactly the beginning of a solution.
Thank you, Chacham. Any other questions, comments?
I saw someone raising their hand, but I don't disappear. So, if we answered everybody's questions.
Okay, with that, thank you so much, everyone, for coming. Chacham, thank you so much. I think, Mr. Garson.
Thank you so much. It's cool as well. Thank you very much for learning with me tonight.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mori.
You.
Toda raba. Yom Tov.